Welcome back to KSCJ Radio, 1360 AM, 94.9 FM in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vikalskis, and this is Having Read That, conversations with authors about their books.
I'm joined by one of the premier political journalists of our day, Mark Halperin, who is out with a brand new book, How to Beat Trump, America's Top Political Strategists on What It Will Take. The book is available now wherever your fine books are sold from the good folks at Regan Arts. Mark, this book, How to Beat Trump, it seems like a very limited readership aimed at maybe the people that are running on the Democratic ticket. Why should the general public care about this book?
Well, if you're a Democrat and you're looking to figure out who to vote for if you want to beat Donald Trump, this is the view of some of the top political strategists in the party I talked to that asked them, what's it going to take? It's hard to beat an incumbent president. It's only happened four times since 1900. And so the question for a Democratic voter is, read this book and figure out if you want to beat the president, who can do it. It's also a history book because, as I said, the history of beating elected incumbents is not very promising. So I wrote the book mostly because I was hearing from Democrats all over the country, we think it's going to be hard to beat Donald Trump. The drumbeat of daily news that suggests the president's in a lot of trouble with impeachment and everything else is a part of the story. But a bigger part of the story is all the advantages this incumbent president has and how difficult the people I interviewed for the book say it's going to beat the president.
Does this particular incumbent president have more advantages than maybe a Ronald Reagan in 84 or Bill Clinton in, you know, when he ran for re-election?
I think he does, and that's based on the interviews I did with these Democrats who said, look, any incumbent has advantages. You can use the power of the Oval Office, the power of incumbency to try to control the story. But Trump, as even when he wasn't an incumbent, was a master of dominating the news. One of the people I interviewed for the book said, Trump doesn't just dominate the news, he is the news. His use of Twitter, his willingness to say and do provocative things, outrageous things in many cases, allows him the ability to leverage incumbency even more than most incumbent presidents. And that's why I say again, people who want to beat the president have to understand what these Democrats are saying, which is, do not think this will be easy. The president is raising a ton of money. He's got a three-year head start on whoever the Democratic nominee is going to be in terms of focusing on the general election. So it's going to be very tough, and people who are concerned about it are concerned about it even with impeachment.
I'm out here in Iowa. I know that you spent quite a bit of time in Iowa just from the various political campaigns you've covered. It seems like the people that I talk to all think that Donald Trump is beatable because of things that he's done, but yet nobody can seem to point to me to one person on the Democratic side who can beat him at this point and give any rational reason for it. Do you think the candidate that can beat Donald Trump is in the race now?
It's a great question, and after the debates, I think it's only been raised more. You've got people like Nancy Pelosi and Barack Obama, Michelle Obama, Bill Clinton, who have been involved at the highest levels of the Democratic Party. You don't see any of them talking about which candidates they think can win because they're worried. They're worried that none of these candidates have the complete package. And as I said, the reason I wrote the book was Democrats said it's going to take a lot to beat the president. I think if you look at what's in the book, the question, how to beat Trump, it's not so much the candidate as it is having the understanding of what it takes to beat an incumbent president and then executing those things. I don't see, and in talking to the people I interviewed for the book, I don't see the candidate right now who has a chance to win the nomination who would be a favorite against the president. And you look at a state like Iowa, where there's so much exposure to the candidates, and you've now seen three different people leading in the polls, and amongst those three plus Bernie Sanders the fourth, you don't see someone who most people I talk to think would be the favorite against the president, and the polls show that. Even polls of Democrats suggest they're worried about winning.
Something I love about this book, and you talked about it being a book of history, you took us back to the 2016 campaign, and you talked about political slogans, and you kind of went back through some political slogans that have gone on over the years, Tippecanoe and Tyler II, all the way up to one I had never heard of before. It was Abraham Lincoln's Don't Swap Horses When Crossing Streams, but it was Hillary Clinton's slogan that's Stronger Together in 2016, a completely benign slogan. What was the deal with that compared to Make America Great Again, and how that the slogan from Hillary's campaign just was not effective?
Yeah, look, should our politics be about slogans as opposed to policy? No, but slogans are so important because they encapsulate for people who are not paying attention to politics every day. Even in Iowa, people are busy as much as people there do a good job of scrutinizing the candidates. So Donald Trump came up with this slogan. It had been used before, but he adopted it, Make America Great Again. You could go to Hong Kong or Venezuela in the 2016 and ask people what's Donald Trump's slogan. A lot of them would know. Stronger together. Even some people on Hillary Clinton's campaign during the campaign didn't remember what their slogan was. I would ask them, "What's your slogan?" They'd say, someone would come up with it. Some of them wouldn't. And she chose a slogan based on being given a list of over 50 possibilities, and basically picked it the way somebody might pick an advertising slogan, rather than really deriving organically from her campaign. And to go back to 2020, you think about these Democrats. What's Bernie Sanders' slogan? What's Elizabeth Warren's? They don't have the kind of short, simple thing that encapsulates their vision of the country, their vision of the campaign. It's just another way that it's going to be a challenge to beat Donald Trump.
Is the Democratic candidate who goes into the 2016 general election going to be hemorrhaging cash at that point and need a huge infusion just to kind of get on an even playing field, if that's even possible?
Yeah. It's one of the huge challenges of beating, again, any incumbent. But Donald Trump has been raising money since before he was sworn in for president. And he's going to have over $1 billion, maybe closer to $2 billion to spend. You look at the Democrats now. Some of them are raising a lot of money, Pete Buttigieg and Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders in particular, but they're going to have to spend it all in trying to win the nomination in this very competitive fight. So one of the things the Democrats I talked to for how to beat Trump were so concerned about was the example of Mitt Romney, the last person to run against an incumbent president. He had a very hard-fought nomination contest in the Republican Party, wins the nomination, and the minute he becomes the de facto nominee, the Obama team rain down on his head millions of dollars in negative ads. So sometime, maybe it'll be in the spring, it might not be till the summer of next year, the Democrats will settle on a nominee. At that point, that person will almost certainly have very little money, maybe no money in the bank, and the president will be laying in wait. It's one of the biggest challenges people identified as their concern, to say, how do you beat Trump? Well, you got to have somebody who can be figuring out how to run in the general election and raise money for the general election, even as they're trying to win the nomination.
I'm chatting with Mark Halperin about his brand new book, How to Beat Trump. He talked to a lot of political strategists throughout the country about, how to take down a sitting president at the ballot box. Mark, I want to go back to 2016. I remember sitting at home and I was watching you and John Heilman on, I think it was Stephen Colbert's show, the night that Donald Trump ended up winning the election. You had covered these campaigns for your show, The Circus, which I haven't watched since you've been off that show, by the way, because you were what made that show run. But you sat there. You didn't seem all that surprised by what was happening. You had your finger up in the wind. Did I misread what your reaction was there? Because you didn't seem all that surprised that Trump was emerging.
I covered the president doing rallies in over 25 states. In Iowa and Florida, all over the country. And I covered a lot of Hillary Clinton events. And I was surprised at how dismissive people were of his chances, not just because the crowds were big compared to Hillary Clinton's crowds, but because people were responding to his message. They liked the show. They liked the rallies and the jokes and all the things he did. But they liked what he said about immigration. They liked what he said about China. They liked what he said about conservative judges. And all of that was right there in front of us. It wasn't something that I think people would have missed if they'd left their comfortable positions in Washington and New York, where most national journalists are. So I wasn't surprised that he won. I also knew that night that it would be a cataclysmic event. That's the word I used on the Colbert show, for the country, because I knew the kind of person Donald Trump is, the kind of reaction he gets both from his supporters and from people who oppose him. And Iowa is a great example. In Iowa today, there are people who are as passionate as any people I talk to in the country about beating Donald Trump. And then there are people who are so loyal to him, are so eager to get him reelected. Even people in the ag sector who have suffered from the trade war with China, many of them who voted for the president last time are ready to vote for him again. So I think that the advantage I had was that I traveled a lot and I talked to a lot of people and I saw the resonance that the Donald Trump's message was having with a lot of people in the country. I wasn't sure he was going to win, but as you said, I wasn't surprised the way a lot of people were.
You mentioned the impeachment process now, and this is the third impeachment go-around in this century that we've had, and the first one was you know, the Andrew Johnson thing back long ago. So it seems like, and there's nothing sexy about this impeachment thing. It's not about sex like it was with Clinton. But do you think that Americans or voters in general, just from the ones you talk to, are kind of getting, you know, they just sort of tune out the whole idea of impeachment unless they really have a vested interest in wanting to get rid of Donald Trump? Because, you know, it's happened three times in the last 50 years now, and we just kind of seem to get used to it.
I think because of the Clinton experience, and because I disagreed from the beginning with Democrats on one of the key points. I think what the president did was clearly wrong. I understand why the Democrats on the merits want to impeach him, but I disagree with them about how sort of understandable this story is to your typical American. The ratings for these hearings have not been very high. Anecdotally, as I talk to people around the country, they don't seem particularly engaged, unless, as you said, there's someone who is determined to eliminate, get the president out of office. I think the real connection between impeachment and 2020 election is what Nancy Pelosi worried about for so long when she put off the movement within her party to impeach the president, which is it's going to be very difficult to get 20 Republican senators to vote to convict the president if the articles of impeachment come to the House. You take somebody like Joni Ernst, who, you know, has been critical of the president at times. Is she going to vote in the midst of her re-election, in the midst of an election year, to impeach the president, to convict the president, remove him from office? Most people I talk to are very doubtful about that. And what Nancy Pelosi is worried about is Donald Trump is great at taking a victory, which, if he survives the removal, would be a political victory, and making hay of that and saying, look, the Democrats tried to get me out of office. They couldn't do it. So what she's been worried about, and a lot of Democrats I talked to are worried about, is this process is only going to make the president stronger. Voters are not going to pay enough attention to see what Democrats are arguing. And it's unfortunate that our politics, you know, is reliant on voters and citizens paying close attention. But they're busy. And as I said, I don't think this story is as clear-cut for most people as say, the Clinton impeachment was or the Nixon impeachment was. Because for a lot of Americans, the question is, well, what happened? Well, the president didn't eventually get any information from the Ukrainians on Joe Biden. Eventually, the Ukrainians got their military aid. Like I said, what the president did was clearly wrong, and privately Republicans will acknowledge that. But I don't think anyone at this point I know thinks that he's going to be removed from office. And like I said, I think he'll do a pretty strong victory lap after that.
Well, and I think back to the Clinton impeachment after the trial in the Senate when they didn't have enough votes to convict. President Clinton held a press conference at the White House and came out very somber and apologized. I don't see that happening with Trump. I see him having a huge rally.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. That his style is not to apologize, not to ever admit wrongdoing unless he absolutely has to. I actually wrote the other day, just for a little fun exercise, a speech that he could give where he could say, you know, I did it, and, you know, maybe some people think it was a mistake, but it's in the past, and let's move forward to, you know, working on the economy and foreign policy, et cetera. So I think you're right. This president will try to move past the result of the Senate, if assuming they don't remove him, in a way that suggests victory rather than apology and unity.
You've been to Iowa so many times covering the caucuses and covering the candidates at the caucuses. Is Iowa still relevant for what it does?
It absolutely is. You know, every 4 years, as you know as well as I do, sometimes states try to move up. That hasn't happened this time, but states and some people in the media are critical. I've always been a pretty big defender, and now I've become a much even stronger defender of the role Iowa and New Hampshire play. Those two states, voters pay closer attention than any other voters in the country. It's kind of a trade-off, in my view, where Iowans and people in New Hampshire pay close attention, and they're rewarded with that, with this outsized influence in who gets to be president of the United States. I think it's important, because otherwise the campaign's going to all be about television ads and big money fundraising. This puts it on a human scale. If you want to be president of the United States, even if you're an incumbent president, you're going to have to go through Iowa, go through New Hampshire, and I think that's great for the process. It's a valuable thing that no other state performs. Even South Carolina, which has had the first in the South contest for so long, and I don't mean any disrespect to the voters of South Carolina, but I have never seen in South Carolina the kind of town halls, the kind of well-attended events all over the state in Iowa and New Hampshire that really put the candidates through their paces in a way that I think is just so valuable for the country. So Iowa will be super influential. The winner of the caucuses may not end up being the nominee, but I think as typically happens, that the field will really be cooled down by the judgment of Iowans.
All right. The book is How to Beat Trump, America's Top Political Strategists on What It Will Take by Mark Halperin. The book's available now wherever your fine books are sold. If you've never read Game Change that Mark co-wrote with John Heilman, go out and read that one, too. One of the best books to cover an election I've ever read. Mark, absolute pleasure talking to you, and thanks for joining us today.
You're very kind. I appreciate it. Hello, Iowa. Take care. Bye-bye.
This has been Having Read That on KSCJ Radio in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vakulskis. Check out all of our episodes on our website, kscj.com. Also, be sure to like Having Read That on Facebook and subscribe to our iTunes podcast. Thanks to segment producer John Weisler. We will be back next time.